The reason for the interviews was the participation of the interviewee with two other women in the Workers' Health Bureau, founded in 1920. Harriet Silverman, now deceased, Charlotte Tobes Stern, presently in New York, and Grace Burnham, now McDonald, were the three active participants in that bureau. Since the history of the bureau is largely unknown and resides only in the memory of the women who had been involved in its work and in the very incomplete files which Grace McDonald has on hand, and a copy of which is at the University of Oregon, the interview was intended primarily to amplify the history of the Bureau. The following interviews deal with the background and some of the details of the Bureau's functioning. Some of the material discussed can be further studied by contacting Grace McDonald, who presently has the files, which now belong to the Retail Clerks Union. It is the desire of Grace McDonald that her role not be stressed, and that it be made quite clear that she was one of a triumvirate who led the very important and now relatively unknown work of the Workers' Health Bureau. It is because of her availability and knowledge of that work that the interview was completed. What follows is a...
What I'd like to do this morning is get a general idea of your background and how you got involved and what the early goals of the Workers' Health Bureau are. Now, I don't know, you know, how long your voice will hold out or anything, so you tell me when you're getting tired. And what we can do is, I'll have to figure out how to handle going through the material and then getting in more detail. But if I get an overall perspective, then I'll know which way to go with it. So if maybe you can, I'll stop and ask you questions, but basically if you can just give me an outline of your background and how you got involved in the workers' movement and what, you know, what some of the influences were in your background.
I think it's important to begin with my father, who was a physician, a neurologist, a research neurologist, and who started the Department of Neurology at Yale. When Sheffield Scientific School, which had been split off from Yale, was abolished and the Yale Medical School was started. I suppose that was around 1906, as far as I can think. When I was a child, my father used to make the rounds at the hospital on Saturday, and he took me with him and took me up to the terminal ward of the women, and there I read to them and wrote their letters and took care of their Christmas trees, and would go there one day and find an empty bed. And it probably made a terrific impression on me. I was probably 8 years old. And there was a great open space around the hospital. And there I would meet the people who were his patients with locomotor ataxia and epilepsy and all the other things. fraternized.
Where were they? Were these people from the mills, mainly?
No. These were simply people who were neurologically handicapped. But I was friendly, and my father would joke with them, and I would have this background. And then he would take me to the jail, where he was the alienist who gave the information on people there as to whether they were mentally stable or not. And I would have that angle. So that was very early in my life.
But you were born in New Haven?
Yes, that's right.
What year was that?
1889. And my father was the graduating class of 1876. So I had a university background because we met all the people. So when we moved from Louisville, Kentucky, after I married, to New York, it was in 1918. And the Big Depression had set in. And I was taking graduate work at the University of Columbia. And went over to the New School for Social Research, which had just been established. And there was a great deal of concern about what went on in industry. And there was a 6 weeks course given where we went to industrial establishments and checked the problems, whether they were doing a good job in ventilation and all those things, or whether they were doing a poor job. And people like Ordway Teed and Stuart Chase, they were all part of this group, Moshe. Well, I was pretty well disgusted with the emphasis on the employer only. And the hope was that these people that were in this training group would become part of the establishment and be working for the big operators. Well, instead of that, the Joint Board of Sanitary Control had been set up following the Triangle Fire. And this was the Shirtwaist Workers Union. It was women, although there were men employed in the different departments, pressers and so forth. And I got a job with the Joint Board of Sanitary Control in the Educational Department.
And that was about 1919 then?
No, it was 20, I guess. And Dr. Price had set up this clinic, which gave complete medical examinations and dental examinations, had x-rays and everything. And also set up this educational department, which held evening classes. I was in the adult education department of New York City Schools. I was a member of the teachers' union. In fact, I was a member of the research local of the teachers' union, which had John Dewey and the Beards and Solon DeLeon and the people at that, John Dewey, I said that, John Dewey, And that was it. Have my pen now from that way back there in 1910. So I had a credential to teach in adult education, and we had classes in the schools at night for the garment workers in the questions of economics and sociology and labor history and so forth. So that was one branch of the Joint Board of Sanitary Control. The other branch had to do with the violations in health standards which occurred in the sweatshops. It was practically all sweatshops. And the group, and I was trying to think of why there were only women, but all of the force was women. There were young women who were recruited to go up the steps and into the toilets, and which were overflowing with fecal material, and where people, workers had their lunch right in these areas, and to check the steam and the hazards and the violations.
So these were inspectors, in other words?
They were inspectors. I was one of them. There were about six others. We would walk up the steps, the rickety steps, and see if there were fire escapes, and check the atmosphere and make reports on the violations.
Did you also talk to the workers, or did you just physically examine the sweatshop?
Well, we talked to the workers. We were allowed to, because this was financed jointly by the union and by the employer.
The Joint Board was?
The Joint Board of Sanitary Control. And it had these various functions. It had the medical department, it had the dental department, it had the educational department, it had the inspection department. And I was trying to figure out, after I talked to you, why only women were inspectors, but that's what it was.
What was the background of most of them? Was it...
They were
social
workers? Social, anticipatory social workers from a large group of people. One of them, Helene Pollock, became married. She was from a big family, and she became probably an outstanding person in New York in social work later.
Excuse me, if you're not busy...
You were beginning to tell me about some of the other women inspectors.
Well, they were a queer group brought together, I suppose, in anticipation of going into social work. And the gamut was all the way from having to earn the few dollars that they earned, and this rich woman from Cincinnati who lived in New York. And this is what we did. So that was that part of it. Well, the head of the educational department was a very outstanding social worker by the name of Harriet Silverman. She died later. Very dynamic and a beautiful speaker. And we felt that this was too confining. It was only touched the ladies' garment workers, the shirtless workers in New York. And we needed to get into the whole question of occupational diseases and the painters and the mercury poisoning among the hatters and Danbury and silicosis and all these other things. So we set up the machinery for the Workers' Health Bureau. And really the focal group at that time were the painters of New York, the Painters District Council. And we set up this advisory committee, which was assisted by the fact that my father had all these connections. And the advisory committee consisted of Dr. Alice Hamilton of Harvard and C.E.A. Winslow, who was the head of the Public Health Association of Yale. He was from Yale, whom I knew. And Emory Hayhurst of Ohio State, who was one of the outstanding occupational disease experts. And the two from Yale, you got them someplace, I'm trying to think of it, Yandel Henderson and Haggard, whom I knew very personally because they lived in New Haven, and I had lived in New Haven. And they're both gone long since, and of course Winslow is gone, Alice Hamilton is gone. I don't know whether Hayhurst is living now or not. And we even had on this advisory committee Peter Wabash, who was the head of the Cooperative League of the USA, in whose office I worked in New York as a volunteer for some time, and with whom I attended the International Cooperative Congress in Ghent in 1924 after my husband died. So you can see the broad sweep of this thing.
Now, there were no union representatives on the advisory committee.
The unions were the committee.
Uh-huh.
The advisory committee was to advise. We had all the unions. We had the International Brotherhood of Painters and Paper Hangers from Lafayette, Indiana. They're now in Washington. And all their locals throughout the country. We had the Danbury Hatters. We had the mine workers.
United Mine Workers?
Yeah. We had all the building trades in the country. Put out the first building trades code, which is still extant and became official code. We had the potters. The Ohio pottery industry was very bad, and Hayhurst, of course, knew about that. Well, I don't have to give you all of them. I have them all.
Did you also have the needle trades? Or you felt they were covered by the
needle trades were covered by the joint board, and they later took in the Amalgamated Clothing Workers into their jurisdiction, so that the needle trades in New York, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers and the ILGWU were taken care of under the Price there, as far as New York was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And we set up a laboratory with X-ray, and we had Dublin from the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, and we had the National Institute of Architects all working together. And we set up this floor in the office building, put in an X-ray machine, and we had a laboratory, and the city of New York was cooperating with us and took care of the samples, laboratory samples that were taken from the workers when they were examined. And the first thing we did was, well, this was all painters, and we examined some 400 painters thoroughly. We had our own doctor in charge, who was paid for by the painters, and the analysis of the records was made by Dr. Hamilton and Emory Hayhurst, and put out, I have all the pamphlets here, and the Painters Joint Council in New York held a mass meeting. There were 4,000 painters in attendance, and Alice Hamilton was the keynote speaker. This is really a revolutionary thing.
What year was that, do you recall? That was
23 or 24. I have all the documents there. And knowing that it would take time to get the preventive things into operation, the first thing to do was to cut down the time of exposure. And we got the first 5-day week in the United States due to Alice Hamilton and the data that we have. The theory being that if you cut down, and this is still true, if you cut down the exposure, you cut down at least some of the potential. You also give the worker a chance to build himself up in the 2 days that he doesn't have to work. We also came out against the use of the spray machine, which was then being used without any protection until it was properly protected, because not only lead, but all these petroleum derivatives were being used for quick drying paints, and they were used in the spray machine. So this was a very definite contribution, you see. And then agreements were made between, at least we worked out a code of agreements between the union and the employer on these different factors.
Mm-hmm. How was the Bureau organized in terms of how many of you were doing the research, for instance? The advisory committee was just an advisory committee.
Well, the active people were Harriet Silverman, myself, and Charlotte Todes, T-O-D-E-S, who was a social worker in Boston who came to help. Then she married, Stern, the sociologist at Columbia, Bernard Stern. And she moved out before we closed the thing, because she went to Seattle. She was married, and she moved to Seattle, where he taught.
So it was primarily the three women there?
There were three women. We had a stenographer. And that's about all.
And the three of you were responsible for collecting the data?
The data came in from the specialist. And the codes were set up for each of the miners and potters. And the Danbury Hattis case was very interesting. The Connecticut had the second occupational disease law in the country. The other one was Wisconsin. And Winslow was responsible for that. And no case had ever come before the commission on mercury poisoning. And here were these young 22-year-old workers in Danbury. You know about how hats were made at that time?
No, I don't.
Well, rabbit's fur, the odds and ends from the fur industry in New York, where they made fur coats and so forth, were treated with an overdose of mercury so that the fibers would knit, the worst kind of poison. And they were used to make the felt hats. And, well, the whole program is here on it. So these boys were simply going to pieces. They were mentally deranged, 22, 23, and no ever case of compensation. And there were no devices in the little shops for protection. We took 100 cases before the Occupational Disease Commission and won them. And of course, the next week or two, the devices began going in. And this was Winslow, who was on our advisory committee, and was at Yale, and was the head of the U.S. Public Health Service. This is how we work. So that was just one case.
Mm-hmm.
Now here was another. Here were recommendations for controlling health hazards in garages and automobile repair shops. And this was a reprint from the Journal of Industry and Hygiene, which I wrote, and which
has your maiden name?
Well, that was my name before I remarried.
Mm-hmm.
And there, prepared for Automobile Mechanics Local, 1528, Chicago, Illinois. And on the back, it gives a bibliography,
mm-hmm.
which includes Haggard of Yale and Henderson of Yale and Alice Hamilton.
How would you define what areas to investigate? The unions would come to you with a problem?
That's right. They would join, and they pay a per capita for the research work. And then we would make a study of their particular. We would refer it to the particular advisory person who was a specialist in that subject. And all this material is here, and this is what they're looking at now.
Then were you actually involved as well in attempting to set up the legislative mechanism to enforce them as well?
We prepared material for the state legislature. Francis Perkins was the head of the industrial of the state of New York at the time. We worked with her on getting codes, getting changes in the law, and we would go to the different. We were in the field all the time, speaking at union meetings, working out the codes, and going from place to place. Steinmetz in Schenectady was one of our advisors. He assigned one of his chemists to work with us. Connected. And we had a terrific clientele, as it were, the top advisor. So we went from place to place. I went all over the country, and Harriet Silverman went all over the country, mining and whatever. And Charlotte worked with the building trades, and I worked with the architect to set up this building trade code, all of which we had here. So this went on until we had a national conference in Cleveland.
What year was that?
Well, I'd have to go down there and get the book. It was the first national health conference, industrial health conference, that was ever held. And it was held in Cleveland, Ohio, and it gives who the people were that sponsored it. Now, we had the head of the Federation of Labor in Pennsylvania, Mara, who was one of our speakers, and Hayhurst was one of the speakers, and Donnelly from the Ohio Federation of Labor was one of the speakers, and it's all there. And this was a summary of what had been done up to that time. And then that was the turning point. because at that time the unemployment situation had set in, and a theory was developed by the less dedicated labor heads nationally that we were usurping their prerogative. And a great deal of this had to do with the fact that although we worked out these codes, they couldn't negotiate them with the employers in most instances. And you can see the power structure began to set up. And our source of income began to dry up because the American Federation of Labor pulled out the contributions from most of the unions that were internationals that were affiliated with them. And you had no income. Not only that, but as I said, the crying need at that time was the question of survival, jobs, and at that time there was no Social Security. There was no old age pension. And the workers were helpless. And so we turned over the office to the Workers' Health Bureau, to the Labor Research Association, which Robert Dunn, and they carried on the campaigns for economic development in the different branches, railroad notes and economic notes and social notes and mining notes. That was when Grace Hutchins and Anna Rochester, who were with the Children's Bureau originally, volunteered and helped with the research for the Labor Research Association. So in 1929, we wound up the Bureau, the Workers' Health Bureau. And there was a period then, of course, of concentrating on labor standards, and they weren't interested in occupational diseases at that time. Now, the interesting thing was that during that period, the universities had departments on occupational diseases, like Harvard and Yale and Ohio and Wisconsin. And during the following period, that was given up. And the whole question of compensation, workmen's compensation laws were set up in different states for different things. And the question resolved itself into attorney versus attorney. The employer would have an attorney, the union would have an attorney, and the decision as to how much the man got for a hand chopped off or a leg or occupational disease became
an individual question.
It became a compromise between the attorneys for the two sides. And the whole work of research in the field of occupational diseases in the university was subordinated to the actual workman's compensation decision. And we have a dearth. It's just beginning to be revived again. And I don't know whether this is what you want. In the way back then.
Then can you give me a general idea of what you did after that then?
Well, I remarried a train dispatcher and we started on the railroad situation because at that time railroad pensions were at the mercy of the railroads. And when a man got near retirement age, he'd be dropped. The job would be abolished. This is what they used. And so there was a big movement for railroad pensions. It was headed by Royster. And it's centered in Chicago, where we moved. And we set up an organization called Railroad Unity. Committee for Railroad Unity. And it concentrated on the problems of railroad workers.
What year was that?
That was in 1933.
When did you remarry?
In 1933, in the summer of 1933. And I helped edit the paper, which was called Railroad Unity News. And that's another story. And that was given up in 1936. And then we moved out here.
But you... career in this has been continuous then?
Well, with the background that I had and with the committee that was set up here, which I headed, which was the California Farm Research and Legislative Committee, and the reporter, which was its official organ. And we have all this correspondence and material from federal as well as state legislators. And of course, with a background on occupational diseases, when Harrison Williams got the bill through and it was signed in December of 1970, then the question became how to implement the occupational health and safety law. And we started to run articles in the reporter, which started, yes. And then there was this gap of all these years between 1929 and 1970. I don't know when you got the first contract with a chemical worker.
The first one we got there was 1965. When this concept again was reorganized or became...
Well, that was before the law went through.
Oh, yes, before the law went through. And there's some interesting commentary that the law actually, as it's now constituted, has stopped our agreement. It created bickering because the issue was, well, if you got to do it legally, then we won't do it by agreement, etc. But it's straightening out again. So the thing has historical background, Grace, to put this into focus. I was thinking really of the history of the Workers' Health Bureau.
Primarily for the historical.
For the historical side of it. Now, at that time, the concept of a joint agreement and the recognition that it was necessary for both and that it could be done on a voluntary basis was unique, and then it died, and mm-hmm. then it became now back again to perhaps this is the best way to go. Otherwise, they're regulated, and with all the acrimony that goes along with regulation as opposed to joint participation under governmental aegis or governmental guidance or governmental referee or whatever you want to describe.
And then you're in the atmosphere today of the public has no confidence in government agencies at this time. And therefore...
good reason for that.
Yeah. But I mean, then if you could go back to the joint agreements,
yes.
You could, and this gives you the history and what was accomplished on the joint agreement.
Tell me, you say it's owned by the retail clerks union?
Yeah.
They own the material?
Well, they paid me $500 for it.
They may not done anything with it.
They haven't touched it, and I...
They
can't, because they don't have the material. And so it's here temporarily until we can get it put together. Then it will be available at their building.
Where are they located?
disease and safety laws, count a state by state. The question became a matter of one attorney for the employer and one attorney for the worker, battling it out to see how a compromise could be made for silicosis or black lung or whatever.
Still going on. The adversary approach is still there.
And the adversary approach has taken the place of the scientific approach for the benefit of the people.
True. And there's no group of experts that advise in this area. There may be a few states that may have a group, but New York has three people who presumably advise on silicosis per se. But there is no, as far as I know, an advisory group. I know there isn't in California an advisory group that would let a referee who's a layman, a lawyer, decide what the technical merits are, the professional merits. It's purely adversary, and it's purely, you believe this witness as opposed to that, and there are professional witnesses on both sides.
You see, the new group, which may go down the drain on account of finances, is a national group. We go from the Atlantic to the Pacific and from Canada to Mexico. And I just got a letter from Texas asking for our material. And it seems that the man that wrote me, which I didn't know until I got the material this morning, was the head of the Schneider. You know, how on earth did he write to me for material? And he was the president of the American Institute of Cooperation. Mm-hmm. This morning I got all the material from the Institute. And I found out that that's who Schneider was. I wrote him, how did you know about it? Well, because they're on our mailing list.
Could we look for a foundation maybe support for something?
We can't because we're in politics. I mean, we support legislation, and if you support legislation, no foundation will do anything.
The historical side.
Honest experience that the union has to have its own technical.
I agree with you 100%. Lauren Kerr, I'm on the advisory committee for the United Mine Workers. And I've been begging Kerr and saying, demanding that he do his own work in this regard. Well, the government does it, and he constantly belabors the government that they ought to be doing more. But the fact remains, he should have his own team.
That department, the Department of Mines, has simply flubbed the whole thing.
Absolutely.
They don't have anything.
Absolutely.
The whole talc thing in California under
it's
the Bureau of Mines
and
nothing.
What the Bureau of Mines has done. Really, in a sense. Criminal over the years, not providing this thing. But the usual politician, with due respect, that says, great law, but then gives you no money to implement it. Now, the unions themselves have never had the money to do it, never had the interest, but the time is coming. When I talk to them, I say, for God's sake, sometimes you've got an economist, you've got a lawyer, you've got to have your own health and safety. But they still exaggerate when they don't have to, and they will not support it, and they go back and saying the government does it, and they get a Bureau of Mines, or they get this law now, and the money is not forthcoming from Congress.
Not only that, they don't have trained people.
They don't, well, it's
the
all...
The inspections
it's all,
are all twisted around.
Exactly, it's great. It's the same story when you were there. It's still...
Well, I tell you...
That's how we can give you their living.
Irving, depends, all the testimony. When my husband testified, and a lot of this stuff is extinct because people put it on microfilm and nobody can use it anymore. If a student wants to study something, he wants to see it in print so he can decide, you know, which paragraph he wants to use and all that stuff. I mean, this is the thing that came in this morning, which absolutely out of this world. This is the Texas guy that wrote me to send him all our material, and he was the president of this thing. And here is the whole question of international agricultural development and rural-urban development, and this all came in this morning. And there's nobody to help me do anything because we have no research fund. Public Relations Department in this associate, which could get out position papers on special subjects. Yes. And that would take a special, you know, special funding. Now, I don't know whether you can. I know Fred. I know Bruce. And I know Don Vile.
But
I've gotten only opposition. I mean, they don't even subscribe to the paper. They want it all for nothing.
Oh.
And,
you know, you might pay an interest in health, obviously. And when they get involved, they get emotionally and passionately involved and really do something about it. It's not a practical game or something.
I started to ask you if you'd like some juice or some coffee.
No, thank you. We'd better get on.
Well, anyway, we've made